Hi everyone, this is Austin welcoming you to the LL Research Radio program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Wednesday, June 18th, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites, the archive website llresearch.org and the community website bringforth.org. Together, they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on the air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLresearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Are we all here and ready?
Yo.
And ready.
Ready to go.
And I forgot to play the intro music, so I apologize to any listeners who are looking forward to that. I guess we can jump right into the opening riff. This comes from, it's not a date, but it is a quote. And quote says, "The Creator wished and wishes and will always wish in that infinitely small portion of its infinite self that is active, to manifest love, to love and feel self of love in action. And so it created its children, children of love and free will, one unit of absolute love that can never change and will never be unique, and an absolute equal portion of infinitely various free will. That is your nature. Your uniqueness lies not in that you are children of love, but in that no two unions of love and free will are the same. To the outer or mathematical eye, to any measuring instrumentation that could be imagined, this uniqueness could not be discerned, for free will, when bonded with love, takes upon itself the quality of love. The free will portion of it, the active portion of it, is forever and in a way that mathematics cannot describe, various. Each of you has an absolutely equal, identical portion of love, and each of you has an equal and unique measure of free will."
Thank you, Austin. I have, on some days, a lot of trouble finding that part of myself that is love, that is a child of love, because I am very various. I just feel sometimes that there's such a different day with every event, with every element that occurs, that how could I possibly create of all of that a child of love? How does that work? I think without Spirit helping us, it wouldn't work very well. And when we don't ask for help from Spirit, it's pretty well doomed. If we think that we can do this by ourselves, we're going to struggle. There's a mystery involved here. Blending our variousness and love. And And I think as we go from moment to moment, we need always to ask for help. Spirit doesn't volunteer. It's not pushy. It's not a teacher. It's a companion. It's a fire that ignites our hearts. It makes us joyful and happy and all kinds of good things, but only if we ask. And thank God for that, because we can always ask. We can always take a moment, take a precious moment, and remember to ask. Come, Holy Spirit. The four of us pray before we begin this session. We always tune to it. We always try to go from being four completely separate and various people, very busy people, involved in all kinds of different parts of L&L work, and on my part, often not L&L work, but just survival and making it through a day, depending on what's going on. But we come from different places, we're different ages, and what we have to do with the tuning is to create in us unity through love. Because that's what we want to give to you, is our highest and best selves. No matter what we're talking about, no matter what question we're answering, we hope that you can hear the love in our answers. What we say and do reminds you that we are children of love. Love infinite, love everlasting, love beautiful and love true. May it always be so.
Thank you, Carla. We can go ahead and get to our questions now. Our first question comes from James R. via Facebook. James asks, after the year of 2012, I think the vibration is pretty strong, though still have 6 chances per day to strengthen or alter our polarity. Are we stepping on another special time track or just shifting from different possibilities of time-space? Some of the indigo and crystal children are deeply in trouble from my point of view. I feel exhausted when dealing with another self. So, what would Latwi do? I'm not sure if James was intending to ask Latwi that question, but we can discuss it.
I think basically he wants to know, what would a wiser person than he do? Sometimes it sounds like he gets overwhelmed by the difficulties that he's facing. I know that feeling. Trying to help people is not always an easy thing. You know, it's not mathematical, as Quo just said.
I'm not sure where James got the notion that there are 6 chances in a day.
I wondered about that, too. I don't know, and I don't question it. That may be true in his world.
I think he was maybe just using that as a way to say there's many chances in a day, that there's still obviously opportunity for polarity to play out and for things to go awry. I don't think he was being literal, but I don't know.
By my calculations, there are 86,400 chances in a day.
I'm glad to know that, Gary.
Which are the number of seconds in any given day. But even then, you know, there's a chance in the moment, and we're always in the moment, no matter what the clock says or the calendar says.
Truly. I think that we did shift vibrations from third density to fourth density at the end of 2012. At the winter solstice, And I think it's developing and enlarging itself, but basically it's fourth density. It's what we're coming to know as a new level of information, lots more information about ourselves out there, and we have to face the truth of ourselves. That's before we can help other people, we have to face ourselves, and sometimes it's not so easy to fall in love with yourself. But that's pretty much what we have to do. Whatever part of the shadow side we're experiencing, we have to love it, forgive it, accept it, and redeem it with the love in our hearts. And the way that we can use whatever the shadow side is, whatever gifts it brings, to the table, you know. We don't have to steal, but we can be more clever. We don't have to kill, but we can be more strong. I think people are often afraid of and sometimes overwhelmed by the shadow side within their natures, especially since fourth density is telling them more truth about themselves. And it makes them more depressed rather than more joyful. So, you know, they need to get work through that. It's something that you have to work through. What do you guys think about that thought?
I think that's sort of the key to James's question here. Mm-hmm. I think many people were holding out in 2012, thinking that maybe when we crossed over this boundary into fourth density that everything would become lovely and it would be smooth sailing from then on out. But we are essentially still in our third density society, third density bodies. We've got the third density veil still. Our unconscious is pretty squarely separated from our conscious mind, and the innate connection to the Creator still isn't just there. It's something that we have to seek in the moment. And so I think that is the key, is that this increase in fourth density light, as you were saying, is an increase of information, an increase of awareness, an increase of the availability of truth. And that is not necessarily an easy thing, especially from our perspective as third density beings trying to exist in a third density society, which is rather confused by the fourth density light. I think it does take a significant amount of self-acceptance and self-awareness and love to be able to really process this fourth density light that's coming through, and it might not always be so easy. And I think as the energy increases, it might be a little more difficult unless people start to understand their shadow work and understand their shadow side and really yield their self-acceptance and acceptance of others that they find in their heart chakra towards these things that are becoming more and more difficult as we become more and more aware of the things around us. Like I said, we're dealing with a 3D society, and Ra said that basically the confusion between our third density society and the fourth density light would cause a little bit of trouble, and that individuals may be experiencing what we would consider mental illness because of this increase in fourth density light, and perhaps they were not able to handle it as well as they thought they could have before this incarnation. And so I agree with James that if he is attempting to say there are many chances in the day to polarize, I think that our ability to polarize at this point in time is probably greater than any other time in this third density cycle, just because it's a strange sort of phenomenon that exist as this fourth density light comes to us while we're in this third density state.
Mm-hmm. And yet, I find, you know, when you can fall in love with yourself, and when you have done that work, it really is just a ton of joy and goodness that is floating all around us. And it really is, you know, all of the things about fourth density that we've been told. It's lovely. But the thing of it is, we're carrying that in our heads. We're not able to put it out there, the third density culture is there. If we can't change it, we can't remake it, it's there. And all we can do is change ourselves. And if enough of us did that, I think it would change the world. But it's a matter of that 100th monkey effect. And I do think that more and more people are trying to do that, and more people are succeeding in doing that. But it's not easy. It's never easy. And when you're trying to counsel kids, yikes. I mean, take the gloves off, folks. It's tough in any world, in any culture, in any when kids are growing and going through a lot of hormonal changes as well as emotional changes and trying to figure out who they are and so forth, and they're feeling isolated and based upon by parents and authority figures everywhere. They don't want to hear from you, you know. And you can't basically make friends with them. There's something else that has to happen. I have had good luck with it, but I don't know what it is I do. I think what it is I listen, mostly. When I've been a school teacher, when I've been a school librarian, I had good luck with simply listening and making the bond between us that of my being able to understand what they're saying and not putting them down, not telling them that they're wrong and that they need to learn what I'm going to teach them. You know, the attitude that I may have something to learn from them is really helpful to them. They feel that support, that, I don't know, that, you know, acceptance, very much so. It may not solve the problem that they're having, but it gives you a place where you can talk about things. And basically, people just, a lot of times, want to talk it out. There's not a whole lot people can do about a certain situation, but being able to talk it out is very helpful.
Yeah, speaking of listening as a service and finding out what the other person needs, I was listening to the TED Talks on NPR on my way here this morning, and an Italian man was talking. Apparently, Italy launched its own version of the American Peace Corps in the 70s, I think. And this Italian man went to, I want to say, Zimbabwe, Zanzibar, maybe Zimbabwe, African nation beginning with the letter Z. And he talked about the international aid effort to help these people. He arrived there with his Italian compatriots, and they saw this fertile, lush valley, but the locals weren't planting things there. So they thought, you're not planting. Well, here's what you do. You need to grow these Italian tomatoes and these other Italian foods, and we will show you how to do agriculture, and we will help you out. And so the tomatoes grew. They were big, plump tomatoes, and then the hippos came and ate off the tomatoes. And he had said none of the Italians had asked these people why they weren't growing there. They just, the Italians showed up with this agenda. And apparently, I don't know how accurate his story is, but this is how he tells it. Apparently, one of the reasons was that the hippos will eat the agriculture, so they don't grow things there. But anyway, he has learned through his years of international aid work that, he, in his opinion, in his assessment, decades, at least 50 years of multiple countries trying to help Africans out of poverty has been disastrous because they arrive with these preconceived notions of what they're going to do. They have these first world nations have these agendas, and they have good intent, but there are unintended consequences. So he had come to this epiphany that the way we need to help African nations, or really anybody in this condition, is to go there and listen. like sit down with the people, have one-on-one, talk to them in their homes. And his idea was that you find out what their passions are, what their needs are, and then you capture that and you try to help facilitate that. And that just struck me this morning as a really confederation-esque way of service. Listen first and then respond. And he used that word too. It's a responsive service.
I remember from the movie Gandhi that when Gandhi was informed by his staff that the next day was going to be a very busy day with lots of meetings and people coming by, that he said, well, I'm going to have to get up earlier then and meditate more. So I think that meditation is really an important way of dealing with all of the catalysts that we come across, meditation, contemplation, prayer, some time that we take each day and either look over the day that's gone by or prepare for the day that's about to come, or both, and make a way for the love to flow through us and for the wisdom to do the same. It seems to require more discipline as time goes on, that people are spread around so thinly with so many different projects that sometimes we forget to spend time for ourselves and with ourselves. And I think that's a good idea to do that, because it gives us a chance to recharge our batteries and to get ready for more work on the front lines.
It's a really important point in meditation, and also it does seem like James is asking for a bit of practical advice and what can be done to maybe not feel so exhausted, or how to use this energy that we're feeling now. And I think another thing is he says that he's exhausted when dealing with other selves. And I'm not sure exactly why that would be, but other selves are our main source of reflection and in this density, and our main source of polarization and acceptance. And so I would say, James, you could perhaps take a look at what it is about other selves that exhaust him, why he is exhausted with other selves. I think one thing that is really common is people will find something about other selves that they don't necessarily like, and they know that they, even though they don't like it, it makes them uncomfortable, they know they're supposed to love it, and so they will consciously just express love for that and sort of overextend themselves in love. And I think it's good that people are realizing that these things need love and that we should be accepting. But also, there's an aspect of the shadow work that we were discussing earlier where, as you might sit down and after meditation, examine those things that made you uncomfortable in that interaction with the other self, whatever it is that you felt you had to sort of extend your love towards, and look at that inside of yourself and see if maybe inside of you, you need to project that love towards you. And then once you come to a balance and acceptance of whatever it is, perhaps next time you interact with that other self, it won't make you so uncomfortable. You won't have to feel this need to project and extend your love, and it's more of a naturally flowing thing that doesn't seem so exhausting.
Word.
It does make sense, Austin, what you're saying. Just the sheer practice, just determination to do it, to get out there and do it, to try to help, to try to listen, to try to be the child of love that density gives you so clearly, in addition to giving you the information about this whatever shadow side you may be manifesting at the moment. All of that, as you get more flexible with it, it doesn't take so much of your energy.
Right. It becomes more of a just moment-to-moment, the Creator's love flows through you, the hand of the Creator plucks harmony in that moment, and it's not really something that you have to actively do, it's something that you just are.
I've felt it lots of times, getting in a zone. You get in a zone, and then things are so much easier. I don't know how to express it, but it takes a long time to get there, a lot of work to get in that zone, a lot of self-acceptance. The work needs to be done first on yourself and then on other people.
Anybody else have any more to add to James's question?
Nope, I thought you guys gave excellent responses.
Well, you were really good with that, how many thousand times you have a possibility, because you do. You have it every heartbeat. Every heartbeat is new. Place to change your polarity.
All right. Thank you, James, for that question. Our next question comes from Erna B. via Facebook. It's a, sort of a long question. Erna writes, "There is one little thing that I ponder often and, quite frankly, can't really comprehend. While Ra has explained the nature of evil better than any other source I have come across," and she puts evil in quotes there, "I still struggle to understand something. If the Creator is all about love, and we are created in its image, and we are sparks of it, and this is all the Creator getting to know itself, or the One getting to know the One, and we have a shadow side, does that mean that the Creator also has a shadow side, a jealous, controlling, mean side? All the characteristics we ascribe to the negative polarity. Is that then why the law of one blinks neither at the light nor the darkness? This is such a quandary for me. The raw material speaks of the left-hand path as that which is not. But how can it then be a legitimate path? I know that Don also struggled with this, and he questioned deeply about it. For example, when he asked Ra why there isn't much growth without the two polarities, like the time before the veil was dropped. Why can't there be growth and evolution in harmony? Ra also said that our particular logos has a bias towards kindness. Are there logoi elsewhere that have an opposite bias? Are our struggles then the struggles of the Creator too, the same way that we need to assimilate and bless our dark side? Is that something that the Creator is also trying to do? Is it learning through us? I know the mystery is inconceivable for us at our present juncture of evolution, but I would appreciate your thoughts on this."
Great series of questions, Erna, and there's a lot of different directions that I'm sure we all could head. And the one that I would like to tackle first is it seems there's a difficulty which probably nearly every positive entity on this planet has, and that's reconciling love with the situation on the ground, and especially in Law of One philosophical terms. What we know is love as compassion, and what Ra says is the second distortion, love, and reconciling that all is love, all is created of love, yet there's clearly an absence of love and a path that allows.
Free will. I mean,
yeah
free will. Love. So who knows what we choose?
So in responding in that regard and focusing on free will, too, I would like to tease out or examine the two different loves here. And my understanding is definitely not perfect and complete on this question. But we on Earth have a working idea of love. That word is used both to that word is both used and misused in innumerable ways.
Mm-hmm.
But in its more elevated and appropriate applications, consensus seems to agree that love includes compassion and kindness and empathy, desire to help, and desire not to harm another person. It's a soft energy, a sweet energy, a warm energy, a receptive and a wholly accepting energy. Those who practice this love are those who walk the path of positive polarity and the desire to serve others. They seek to respect, not abridge, free will, and they seek to become aware of the Creator in all things, both self and other self included. And this love has as its diametric opposite a complete omission of love, which manifests in the negative polarity as a desire to control and manipulate others for the benefit of the self. But love at this level, as it's experienced or as it's blocked in the green ray or heart chakra, isn't yet the big love, the love or logos that in the Law of One material is identified as the second of the three primal distortions that emerges at the absolute genesis of creation. The second distortion love, Ra identifies as the creative principle, and it is that which, through the agency of free will, focuses intelligent infinity, and in so doing creates everything we know, everything we can imagine, and everything beyond our knowing and imagination, all out of light. And the world we experience now and the densities and octaves ahead of us and behind us are all a result of this ongoing present moment mating dance between the first and second distortions and their offspring, so to speak, the third distortion, light. This love that created all there is by focusing intelligent infinity is not the love that says don't hurt another person. Rather, it, through its own investment with free will, this love or logos or creative principle calls forth the third distortion of light and the infinite manifestation, and the manifestation that is infinite takes shape, and each universe forms with its own, as Ra said, natural laws. So within the parameters of these natural laws, all possibilities are open for exploration, including the movements of creation and destruction, growth and decay, cycles of time and cycles of space. And in the infinite possibilities that arise in a universe made of light by love, using its free will, one interesting experiment emerges, or has emerged, in our own octave. The Logos, in order to facilitate spiritual evolution and the return to oneness that Erna describes, introduces what Ra calls a veil of forgetting. This veil creates and isolates a conscious mind, and in so doing renders the unified and divine nature of the universe hidden, not immediately apparent to that conscious mind. So then the entities partaking of and participating in this environment where love seems withdrawn, these entities, who are sub-sub-logoi themselves, are likewise free to explore each and every possibility through their own investment with free will. And unfortunate though it may seem from our perspective, one possible activity that arises as a result of the veil is the possibility of inflicting pain on another. But it doesn't stop there. The possibility opens up a whole valid road of service, the conscious manipulation, control, and enslavement of other seeming portions of the Creator, or what in moral terms we might describe as evil. So the second distortion, the big love, embraces all of these possibilities, even those that explicitly deny and actively reject the love that we associate with the green ray or heart chakra. Not only does the second distortion, logos, embrace, but more fundamentally, it created the conditions and the possibilities necessary for what some might call evil or the shadow and all manner of fear-based thought and activity. There is nothing that this second distortion rejects or abhors. As you quoted, Erna, quote, the law of one blinks neither at the light or the darkness. So the Creator is indeed, as you wrote, all about love, but that love, to the extent of my tiny understanding, isn't the green ray love, though green ray love is the center which springboards the journey to the sacred contact with the second distortion love.
What do you say it is, the blue ray distortion of love? Love dealing with truth? Is that where you're going with this?
To the best of my understanding, and I could be mistaken about this, but the second distortion love I would associate with opening the gateway, the indigo, sort of sacramental, sacred understanding of the nature of things, if it's to be associated with a chakra.
No, I wasn't trying to make it, you know, pin it down to a chakra. I was asking you if that's what you were thinking.
Yeah, I kind of left that thought incomplete.
So you're not thinking that. You're thinking that it's green ray, what? Indigo, right?
Yeah, I was just trying to differentiate between the green ray love that makes it very difficult to reconcile the negative polarity and the larger love, quote unquote, the second distortion love. I think we most fundamentally experience that second distortion love, that awareness of love within all things through the indigo, which is, of course, only opened as a result of the heart at first being opened and mastered, and energy then moving through an opened and balanced blue ray.
Yeah.
I was looking at the part where he asks about why there isn't much growth without the two polarities, like the time before the veil was dropped. Why can't there be growth and evolution in harmony? I think that that's a significant question and point, and I think that in order for there to be growth, there has to be something missing, something out of harmony, something not right. Originally, the Creator decided to know itself and then made the creation so that this desire to know itself could be manifested. So the Creator was kind of beginning from, I need more knowledge of myself. I'm not aware enough of what is possible. And I think that basic feeling of needing more, needing to grow, does come from what we might see as a disharmonious or unbalanced or a situation which is not all that it could be. So that there's this yearning that is set up in us to go forward and to be more this or that, more loving, more wise, more confident, more helpful, whatever. Or to be less angry, less doubtful, less confused. So we're always looking for a way to perfect ourselves. It reminds me of a song we use for tuning Sunday, All Things Must Pass. George Harrison was singing about we come back millions of times, life after life, so that we can become a perfected being. Lord, help me to burn out this desire. So I think that really that is the thing, that we need to have some sort of an itch or a desire, a yearning to do more, to be different, to grow. And it comes from a feeling of not enough, of a lack. And I think that's sort of a divine difficulty, shall we say.
I think that's a great explanation of the basic need for this negative polarity in our direct illusion as we recognize it. I pulled back a little bit when I was thinking about it to even a wider perspective, in that Ra sort of hints to us that divs are sort of explorations of polarities. And they say that, for instance, from the last octave, we gained the harvest of mover and moved polarity, which in more basic senses would be a type of positive and negative polarity, or a giver and a receiver polarity. And there's a sort of a metaphysical theory that the way that existence even exists is because of a sort of dynamic tension between two polarities. Or many polarities. And that's even reflected in the idea of modern science in something like string theory, when if you imagine that our reality is made up of basically an infinite number of tiny strings that are vibrating, if you imagine a string, it can't really vibrate unless you have tension on it. You have to be able to pull two sides, one direction and the other direction, for that string to be able to vibrate. And so I think that the idea of polarity is kind of what even springs our reality into existence, and that each octave is exploring a new polarity to offer the next octave a new type of dynamic tension to exist on. And so in this octave, I think it is just we ethically realize the polarity we're experiencing and exploring as service to others and service to self. But in a grander sense, it is a polarity that it's essential for the Creator to experiences polarity and explore it fully, which means that we have to go fully on in one direction or fully in the other direction. And so that tension is then offered to the next octave, and the next octave can vibrate its own strings, if it's even anything like this reality, based on the tension that we have explored in the polarities of this octave. And that's sort of what I got from the necessity of exploring polarities and why progress can't be made without the negative polarity, because it is literally what we are meant to do, is explore the two different directions as fully as possible to offer that tension.
I got from Ra's description of life before the veil in Book 4 that progress was possible. The entity could continue their evolution from third density to fourth and fifth, etc. But apparently they were too lazy and screwed it up for the rest of us and caused the Logos to have to figure out some way to motivate the journey. So the Logos then devises this novel experiment in the veil. I agree, though, with you in principle.
Yeah, Rod did say that there was slow progress, I think, but essentially the entities weren't motivated to polarize. And I think if we view things as sort of all happening simultaneously, and then the Logoi non-simultaneously offered more and more free will, eventually free will inevitably discovered this polarity that would offer the dynamic tension. So while the progress was possible before that, it was a natural progression for the Logoi to continually offer more and more free will until the, I guess, crux of this octave was discovered in the two different polarities.
That's an interesting thought, that you said there's inevitability to the advent of the veil, because, I mean, the creator, of course, wants to explore infinite possibilities. If that's a possibility, why not explore it? The sense I got from Ra, though, was that it was like a corrective action. Had those entities in our particular octave been doing their homework as they should have, then maybe the Logos wouldn't have had reason to explore that possibility.
But if you're aware that you're the creator and that everybody's the creator and all is one and all is well, there's no real reason to do anything.
So you just sort of have to capture it yourself so that you can slip back and forth and up and down and get some time and type there.
I would have said
it's an airplane term, meaning just experience, just doing it over and over and over again until you're used to it. And you don't think about it anymore. It's muscle memory. And then you're good to go. You know, you can help people because you're not thinking about it anymore. You're ready to listen. You're not involved in the process of getting ready to listen.
Yeah, and in response to what Jim said, when you're aware that all is the creator, then you're right. What is there to do? I mean, your essential identity is. I mean, that can't be changed. It's permanent. So the veil then, basically, one way to look at it is a mechanism that just causes you to believe something that is not. Believe that you're separate and believe that you have to do this work. Well, I guess you have to do the work regardless, but believe that there's something very important to do.
And then you do things, and there are repercussions, and the momentum is built up, and you continue working towards whatever your goals are, and then what we call evolution takes place, and you go further along the line of evolution, and eventually get back to the creator, and you discover, wow, you know, all is still well, all is still one, but look at all these goodies I brought, because I convinced myself for all these millions of lifetimes that it wasn't well. There's a fruit from the illusion.
To touch on the idea that Gary was talking about, the advent of the negative polarity being a corrective response due to the laziness of the prevail entities, I would, trying to look at it in the octave sense, where you pull back and each octave kind of exists simultaneously, and we as third density entities can see and conceptualize the beginning of this octave versus the end of this octave, and conceive of a previous octave and a next octave. But if we attempt to, which I don't think we can really conceive of it as simultaneously, but if we attempt to conceive of the octave as happening simultaneously, the negative polarity as we know it was already going to exist as the end of the octave, as the ultimate culmination. I think that because it was something that naturally came out based on the extension of free will, Ra, at some point in the Ra material, kind of makes a comment that puzzles Don when Ra said that it was only after the Logoi offered the entity's free will that the negative polarity came about. And so Don questioned whether that meant that free will wasn't really present in the previous non-veiled octave or previous non-veiled entities. And they said that it's not necessarily true. They did have free will as far as they could understand it, but it just wasn't significant enough of free will to truly access the possibilities that are available within this octave.
Which is an awesome point and ties into why Ra interchangeably calls the law of free will the law of confusion. Because you basically just have to confuse. Exercising free will to begin with is an exercise of confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess for somebody to truly express their free will, they have to be confused, and it has to be like a real choice.
But have we really tackled the question of whether the Creator has a negative side? You know, is there, what does he say? Does the Creator have a shadow side, a jealous, controlling, mean side, all the characteristics we ascribe to the negative polarity? Well, we know that it does. It includes all of those things. But how? I mean, we can't be sixth density. We can't reconcile them. We just can't.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we can answer that question.
Well, before there was a creation, there was only the Creator. So as Don figured out, the only concept of service then was service to self.
Yeah.
Only when there was a creation and an other self was the possibility of service to others brought forth. But I don't think the Creator is sitting around. I mean, how evil can a Creator be when the Creator is all there is? I'm going to step on my toe. I don't know. How do you do this?
I do think it's a good question that Erna asks, because it's hard to imagine. When we talk about the Creator, we kind of imagine a godlike entity. And when we say the Creator is love, we imagine this godlike entity only being able to love. But I don't think that really gives the full picture of what the Creator really is. When you can ascribe any behavior to a human, you can ascribe that behavior to the Creator, because each human is the Creator. We are the Creator expressing and experiencing itself. So when a person is mean or jealous, the Creator itself is being mean or jealous. But I think it ties back into what Gary was talking about, the ultimate second distortion of love with a big L. Even though an entity can be mean to another entity and the Creator can be mean to itself, it loves that and accepts the fact that it can be mean. It loves and accepts the behaviors that we as humans might look at and say, that's a negative behavior. The Creator, the ultimate Creator, doesn't view it as negative. It loves it. It accepts it as it is. And I think that's the ultimate love of the Creator, is even though the Creator itself does have a shadow side, the Creator itself loves that shadow side. And that's how love ultimately trumps that negative path, is it is the path of accepting. And while the path of non-acceptance obviously will not accept the loving side accepts the non-loving side, and so eventually, ultimately, and inevitably absorbs that non-loving side, because it is accepting and it pulls while the other rejects. And so at the very end, everything integrates. It's the pull and absorption that prevails versus the separation.
I get into trouble with language trying to answer this one. Because, like, Austin, you started out talking about godlike entity. The way this question is framed kind of invites the reader to conceive of the creator in sort of anthropomorphic terms as being possessed of certain qualities, where if you read mystical literature from those who have had that direct immediate revelation, they all describe, you know, ultimate truth, not the relative truth that forms the context of our own experience. But ultimate truth is having no qualities, being beyond qualities. It contains all qualities, but of itself has no qualities, no adjectives that can describe it or be attributed to it. But somehow, nevertheless, all qualities arise out of it. And I think, Austin, you're talking about how love absorbs that non-love. So how can you say the Creator has these attributes? Well, yes, how could it not? Whatever possibility arises in our experience or in any corner of the infinite universe, whatever that possibility, it has to ultimately spring from the Creator. But do you say that it's the Creator, or do you say that it's the illusions of the Creator, those entities that believe they are not the Creator that have these sides? And it becomes difficult for me to attribute, like, responsibility. But I would have to, like, put that all under the umbrella of, well, it is all the Creator, and everything springs from the Creator. So the Creator, yes, must be possessed of any possibility, whether it's jealous, whether it's human jealousy and meanness, or whether it's a lake or a river, whether it's space or time, etc.
Do we have any more to add to Erna's question?
Well, I think that what we're all looking for is that place where we become that creator that slips up and down the scale of free will and is able to be the shadow side and then reconcile it with love on the run as it goes. And we don't know precisely how to do that, and without spirit we can't do that. There's a mystery involved here, and we just have to depend on something beyond us to help us out. Because I don't think God doesn't have sides. That's a creation of us. We've created that, and it's real to us. And I'm not saying that you can't prove that it's real, because you can't. But it's real in this density. There's a problem here of having the capacity to let it all go and let it all kind of muddle in the mind and then bring in a unity that we don't understand and accept that that works. It's a mystery that we can take part in, but we can't understand.
Agreed, and well said.
All right. We have about 4 minutes left. I apologize to the caller that's on the line. We don't have time to take another question right now, but we will be back next week on...
Why don't we try?
Do you want to try?
Absolutely.
We can go over. Okay. Caller from 860, anybody else who's listening, if the show ends, you can always listen to it again in the archive on our Blog Talk Radio show, Blog Talk Radio page, blogtalkradio.com/LLresearch. And a caller from area code 860, you are now live on the air. And with whom are we speaking?
Hello, guys. My name is Ryan. I'm actually a Bring Forth member on the forum. I know you've answered one of my questions in April. It's Hot Sizzle 77. Yeah, how's it going? My question for you guys, though, thank you for answering. I know I called it a late time, but my question was, why do some wonders remember more than others. Why is it that some have the capability of bending metal or anything godlike? I mean, is it, are they born like that? Is it some kind of pre-incarnated plan?
It's a gift.
Okay.
Gift all my life. I haven't been able to explain it, but that it is involved in knowing. Knowing absolutely that all is well and all will be well. And it gives me the capacity to deal with a lot more than some without, you know, blinking an eye. And it's not fair, but some people are given a gift, and they're given a remembering. And other people are not given any gifts at all, and they just have to muddle through.
I definitely do think that some people have made this choice prior to incarnation to have a certain gift, have a certain ability to share certain types of gifts with the people here. But there is a great raw quote that talks about, I'll just read it, and that sort of explains why some wanderers may have more abilities than other wanderers. And Ra says, there are many wanderers whom you may call adepts who do no conscious work in the present incarnation. It is a matter of attention. One may be a fine catcher of your game sphere, but if the eye is not turned as this sphere is tossed, then perchance it will pass. If it turned its eyes upon the sphere, catching would be easy. In the case of wanderers which seek to recapitulate the degree of adeptness which each has acquired previous to this life experience, we may note that even after the forgetting process has been penetrated, there is still the yellow ray activated body which does not respond, as does the adept which is of a green or blue ray activated body. Mm-hmm. Thusly, you may see the inevitability of frustrations and confusions due to inherent of manipulating the finer forces of consciousness through the chemical apparatus of the yellow ray body. What I get from that is that some wanderers may have some adept experience from previous lifetimes that would be totally possible for them to express in this lifetime, but due to the nature of free will, they just simply haven't explored that possibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're fighting their body sense, they're fighting the culture. Mick, you've got a gift for saying something in a short way. Why don't you have at it?
Well, I think everything comes down to pre-incarnative choices, and there are all kinds of reasons for making choices that would include more or less of what we call gifts. And mm-hmm. I think if somebody really wants to make some progress toward these latter days when we've got maybe one more incarnation left, then they would probably program for less of the gifts and more of the necessity for one having to do the work him or herself. And, mm-hmm. you know, kind of a sweat your way to realization rather than have all these extrasensory perceptions giving you hints and clues here. And I think a lot of times that the gifts are given to people who maybe not so far along on the path as those who don't have the gifts. Mm-hmm. Just my hunch.
That is a fantastic point that I hadn't, it had never occurred to me that the wanderer, especially in the closing days of third density, may not want that and may want to, like you said, sweat it out. My other two thoughts to offer the question, I guess it's just kind of an elaboration on the point Jim already made, that a variety of factors will go into this pre-incarnational programming that will set up the blueprint for the life to come and open the possibility that the wanderer may remember more or may remember less. One of those reasons that may go into that decision-making process is that that particular gift may be mission-specific, may be needed for a particular purpose. Say in Jesus' case, Ra says that young entity Jesus remembered more than most do, and from Atlantean times. Perhaps he remembered not due to aptitude per se, though that must factor in as well, but he remembered because he signed up for a specific mission in that lifetime, and that mission needed the remembering. Whereas in many other cases, maybe the person could do equal the work of the one who was Jesus, but doesn't have that, doesn't choose to make that particular mission, so doesn't remember.
Mm, okay, yeah, good point, guys. Thank you. So, I mean, ultimately, essentially, you really don't need these gifts to progress spiritually and help the planet, you know?
Right.
You can say that, yeah. You don't need these gifts. You don't,
matter of fact,
you don't need
if you have a gift, you might just sort of rest on the gift and not do the work, not proceed and be as much aware as the one who has had to sweat it out, as Jim says.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for calling in, Ryan. That was a great question.
No problem. Thank you for taking the guys. I know you guys went over the hour.
It was funny
because Austin said sorry for the caller, and I was just about to hang up, and then I heard Carla say, "Oh no, we could take one." So,
yeah,
that's my gift in action. Oh, we can do it. It'll be fun.
Thank you guys. Take care.
Glad Carlo decided to take that. It was good to hear from Hot Sizzle 77.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for calling.
Goodbye.
No problem. Thank you.
And you've been listening to LL Research's In the Now Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our website, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those of you who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week. We'll be here next Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and we'll talk with you then.
I run through a wooded aisle and chase the sunlight mile after mile. And I feel like I know this place as a tree line breaks in the wide open space. I stare at a bright red sun, search all day and never find anyone. Haunting tone and I'll make